Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Quentin Hardy, Deputy Technology Editor of the New York Times and your moderator for today's program. And now, it's my pleasure to introduce today's special guest, Dylan Radigan. Dylan Radigan is, by the description of his own website, mad as hell, infuriated by government corruption, corporate communism, banksters shaking down taxpayers. He's also got issues with our broken-down healthcare system, our addiction to foreign oil, and our failing schools. At least you know where the guy's coming from. More important, at a time when outrage is in notable fashion and realistic solutions are in short supply, he says there are ways to fix these problems. He may be uniquely qualified for the task, having lived in the houses of both the humble and the great. Mr. Radigan was raised by a single mother in upstate New York, graduated from Union College, and after some period of knocking around the United States, became a business journalist at Bloomberg LP, just as the news service aimed at the financial sector was entering a period of explosive growth. From print, Mr. Radigan made a successful career in financial television, creating and starring in the show Fast Money on CNBC. The show, which offered stock tips and market insights, was one of the highest-rated shows in the history of the network. Nonetheless, Mr. Radigan walked away from the network after the events of the 2008 financial crisis and turned his eyes to a bigger story. What he sees is a systemic corruption of America by its most trusted beneficiaries. It is a theme he now pursues on MSNBC's The Dylan Radigan Show, on his commentary in The Huffington Post, in a radio show called Radio Free Dylan, and in his recently published book, Greedy Bastards. Greedy Bastards, which I'm told is currently number 9 on the New York Times bestseller list, is subtitled, How We Can Stop Corporate Communist Banksters and Other Vampires from Sucking America Dry.
Subtlety is my thing.
I guess we're done.
That's what I do.
Got yourself an amen corner.
You figure it out.
As you can tell, it is both a gerrymand about our present state and a prescription for change. Dylan Radigan will talk about his big book for a bit, and then something he calls the 30 Million Jobs Tour, which he launched today. We'll have a brief conversation, and then we'll take questions from the audience. Please welcome Dylan Radigan.
Thank you. Thank you. So just a little bit of background on the book itself, which was written really as three books. The first one was a documentation of what I saw as all of the misaligned interests in banking, trade, energy, health, education, and our government. And honestly, the book was relatively useless and just would have infuriated you and left you with nothing, which is how I felt when I was done with it. I was pretty ticked off when I started writing it, and so it was maybe a therapeutic event for me, but it wasn't much worthy of publication. What I realized, having sort of gone through that and through my own realization that a lot of the moral outrage that I was channeling coming out of CNBC, while it was potentially good television, it was not particularly useful to the conversation in solving problems, or certainly in what I saw as my responsibilities as a participant in the attention-seeking madness of this economy. To use that ability to accumulate attention in a way that actually may create some value, as opposed to simply indulge whatever my own outrage or ego might be feeling at the time. And what became readily apparent to me, having sort of participated in first the healthcare debate on MSNBC and then the financial reform debate on MSNBC sequentially in 2009 and then 2010, was the realization that having watched $600 million come in to the government during the healthcare debate, only to see the health insurance monopolies perpetuated, the drug monopolies perpetuated, the employer-based healthcare system perpetuated, et cetera, and then subsequently watching the financial reform debate, only to watch the perpetuation of a secret dark credit derivatives market that has now grown from $600 trillion to now $708 trillion since the financial crisis and the perpetuation of the massive banks themselves, it became apparent to me that no amount of debate, certainly not in the 4 o'clock time slot on MSNBC, was going to amount to much of anything. And for that matter, it didn't matter if you were where you were. The most powerful commentators, the most powerful politicians in the world were incompetent or incapable of actually affecting that change, which I think is a frustration that everybody in this country has been feeling, regardless of whatever your point of view is. And so for me, having finished that first version of the book, it became apparent to me that we had to really understand what the root dysfunction is, with it. We're not even talking about what the problems are. We're in this perpetual state of political debate about symptoms of the problems, including the housing crisis or unemployment or poverty, which are presented politically as problems, but are actually symptomatic of the broader dysfunction and the lack of investment in this country. And the lack of aligned interest between the wealthy components of this country, and whether it's the trade agreements or the bank system, our banking system, excuse me, or the tax code, and the desire to achieve prosperity and innovation and entrepreneurialism and just stability by the balance of this country. And it struck me that if you don't actually talk about what the problem is, you will never obviously solve it. So my goal with this book is not to provide you with my personal prescriptions as to how to solve these problems. My goal with this book is to reframe the conversation around what I see as the core issues, in the hope that we will move from left versus right or Democrat versus Republican to force the creation of actual coalitions around how to reform banking. Why does your opinion on investment policy have anything to do with your opinion on the environment or guns? It's insane. Why does your opinion on trade policy have anything to do with your opinion on abortion or immigration? It's insane. And in an industrial era, it may have made sense because it was all we had, but we know that we now have the benefit of discrete data. We are able to actually individually identify ourselves as unique data points in this universe as we engage with one another, which gives us the ability to then align around an issues-based debate. And so my goal with this entire undertaking is to lay out what I see as the core misaligned interests in our banking, trade, health, energy, education, and government systems, in the hope that I can enlist you and as many people as I can in this country to help me and for me to help you move towards getting more aligned interests in those things. It is not a very complex concept, but if we don't actually have those debates, if we don't speak about things in that principled sense, we live right now in a world that is wedded to exchange of power through ideas and mechanics, but is lacking in principles and values for how to do that. And my goal was to establish a framing for those principles and values, and that really goes to the title, which is obviously Greedy Bastards, which I intended, and the cover I hope speaks to it, to depower that phrase a little bit. It's a phrase that comes with a tremendous viscerus in it and a tremendous indictment of an identity, some person. If we can just find the room full of greedy bastards, we could fix this country. Wherever we can just find, where are they? You know, we got to go greedy bastard hunting. The fact of the matter is, greedy bastardism, at least as I argue it in the book, is a value system, that it is not an identity, that we are all greedy bastards, or at least capable of greedy bastard-like decision-making, and that the only distinction is that those with great power have a much greater ability, when they exhibit that behavior, to do damage. So the magnitude of the impact of somebody with wealth and power is much greater, but the decision to exhibit that value system is a universal human experience, and my hope is to provoke a conversation around what are the values that are the antidote to that, which I obviously argue in the book, revolve around the enforcement of a culture of visibility, which I think is our only actual hope, because it's rich people and government getting together to screw over poor people is as old as human beings. You talk to the pharaohs, you talk to the samurai. So it's not like we're like, oh my goodness, I can't believe the rich people are working with the government to screw over the poor people. Well, yes, that's what they do. You know, they've always done that. You know, there's no reason to get too worked up about it, okay? It's what's happening. It's always happening. Now they have new technology and new techniques, but so too does the world. And I think the unique and sort of exciting part of where we find ourselves, and also the scary and dangerous part of it, is that we have, for the first time in the history of the planet as human beings, the capacity to enforce a blanket of shared visibility around the world that will, I believe, inherently increase the integrity of any given decision. And that it is the integrity and choice in any given decision that creates the highest probability of you and I, or whoever it is, any group or a company or whatever it is, having aligned interests. And it is absent that visibility that you lose the integrity and that you lose the ability to make those choices. And the last thing I'll say, and then I'll let you have at me, is this. It is easy to make decisions with visibility, integrity, and choice 95% of the time. The 5% of the time that you really don't want to have to do it is actually the only time that it matters that you do it.
And that's the part they call character.
Right. And that is the part. And we have been practicing this, by the way, on my staff over the past year, because we try to enforce it on each other. And I'm here to say it's a nightmare.
Okay. How refreshing.
So, but it makes for a much more rewarding and effective culture if you can deal with doing it, which is why, by the way, the ruthlessness of it is easy to aspire to, and it's macho, and you're like, we're just going to do this. But the trick, obviously, is the compassion, because it is only with the compassion that you're able to actually resolve these things. It is, like I said, moral outrage is easy, but it doesn't solve problems. And it's only if we are willing to sort of witness the guts of our own misaligned interests with ourselves and with each other that we can then even begin to resolve it. And we can only resolve it in the context of a vastly more compassionate relationship, first off with ourselves and then ultimately with our communities and our country and our world. I'm done.
All right. Thank you all for coming. All right. Well, that's very refreshing because, you know, when you see the book and it's got this explosive cover and it says Greedy Bastards, I got to say, let's underline a couple things you just said. I got to say, it looks pretty much like an us-them kind of concept.
Yep.
Oh, those greedy bastards out there, they did it. As Groucho Marx said in one of his movies, he's very flummoxed, and he says, there must be someone I can sue.
Right. You know? That's right.
Like, who can I blame?
Yeah.
And that, of course, you know, you're a creature of cable.
Yeah.
And that's a common trope on cable news, of course. You know, who's the other side? Who are the bad guys out there? And this is the channel that understands you, the audience, like no other. Much of cable, and you and I have both worked in cable a great deal, is about affirming the audience's point of
view.
It's
a business.
Yeah, you want people to transcend that. You're saying what?
It's not that I want that. It's what's happening.
Right? Go ahead, say more.
I mean, remember, there are 311 million people in this country. The vast majority of them do not watch cable.
Okay.
They don't watch MSNBC. They don't watch Fox. They don't watch CNN. They don't watch any of that.
They just seem to fill up the political
zeitgeist. Well, they're doing whatever. They're with their family. They're in their own life. And just to speak to the cover, the cover is basically an effort to meet what I see as the audience where they are, which is angry and frustrated and looking for an identity for who to sue, and take the reader and the audience from where they are, which is where I have spent much of my past few years of my life, to where a lot of people who have been teaching me, and I suspect many people in this room who are no longer in that place, if you ever were in that place, have taken themselves. And so my goal with this book was to be able to speak to the lizard brain in all of us that wants to do that, and then sort of offer a guide to an alternate path other than burning yourself in the town square or murder or whatever it might be.
You want people to attend to the better angels of their nature, to look to the longer game than the next quarter's earnings, or the next hot stock to pop, whatever the next big, and think longer and deeper about their relationship.
And the realization that the only thing that we actually control in our lives is our own intent.
Yeah.
We have this outcome-based obsession, whatever it might be, but all of us have obsessed over a lot of outcomes that have never happened, and a lot of us have received outcomes that we never expected. We can't control them, but we can control our own intent. And if our intent is to seek to align our interests within our communities and within our families, that is the only path through which we will go to resolution. And I actually believe that the collective pain and suffering that we are all experiencing, not just in this country but around the world, is providing a remarkable, albeit toxic, incentive to force people individually to achieve this different sort of a way of making and making decisions and forming relationships and how we function with each other.
Now, you had seen many cycles, and you're some student of history, and you'd read about many cycles.
Yeah.
What happened in 2008 that made you think, this really is different, I need to act? Right. What did you see?
Well, I was of the belief, both at Bloomberg, when I was working for Bloomberg and when I was working for CNBC, that the act of having a vigorous debate about what money should do relative to ideas and where money and ideas should match one another was a remarkably admirable and necessary task. Mm-hmm. And I, quite candidly...
How did money and ideas express themselves? Would that be buying
stock market? Yeah, maybe in simplest sense. Why does Wall Street exist? Okay. Why do we create a capital market?
To exchange information.
To exchange money with ideas in order to develop those ideas. You walk around and you're like, why does Wall Street exist? I'm like, well, so you can get rich. I'm like, oh, so you think that we subsidize this massive apparatus in this country so that people can get rich?
No.
No.
To try and efficiently allocate...
That's the intent. And I viewed myself as a participant in that conversation, as a student in that conversation, and I enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm.
I was, quite candidly, naive. I was not aware. I did not know. I did not understand that laying underneath all the wonderful companies and Genentech and all these things you can talk about, biotech and information, that underneath it was not just obviously the bond market and the commodity markets, but the bond market. But underneath the bond market was and still is a completely empty insurance market. That is this credit insurance market that was invented in the late 1990s under Bob Rubin with Bill Clinton and the whole gang. And it was invented with what I personally believe was actually the best of intent, which was, we'll use technology to create distributed risk and blah de blah de blah. I did not understand that they were allowing these AAA-rated financial institutions, whether it was AIG or GE or JP Morgan, to issue credit insurance without posting any collateral whatsoever. And if you can sell insurance on something without incurring any expense in the act of selling it and then collect premium every month from selling that insurance, your only incentive is to insure as much debt as possible. And if your incentive is to sell as much insurance as possible on debt, well, then you need to manufacture as much debt as possible. And that was, I didn't connect all the circuits on that back end until 07, 08 and watch that whole thing sort of reveal itself.
Mm-hmm.
And these people are 100-to-1 leveraged, 100-to-1. You can't go leverage 100-to-1 in the stock market. You can't go leverage 100-to-1 in the bond market.
Emotion fear or anger?
My first emotion was shock. My second emotion was, well, we have to do something about this. So I called Terry Donahue, who's the CEO of the CME, and I said, can you put swaps on an exchange? If they wanted to collateralize them, can you handle four variables on exchange? Because credit insurance requires both a geographic location, where is the loan issued, houses in San Jose, a time duration, well, houses in San Jose for the next 3 years,
sure,
and then a timestamp. And Terry's like, yeah, we can do that. And I honestly, at that point, still naive, I'm calling over to the New York Stock Exchange and the DTCC, who keeps track of all these things. I'm like, you have the CUSIPs on these things? Can we put them on an exchange? And I actually thought that the TARP money was going to be used as the seed capital to capitalize a swaps exchange that would then force a bank restructuring and we would move on with our lives.
And make visible everything.
And then you'd powder the stuff that was garbage, you would post the stuff that was legitimate, and you would move on with your life. And that didn't happen and still hasn't happened. And that was the breaking point for me, because when I realized that their intent, meaning the policymakers' intent, was not to resolve what had been revealed, which mm-hmm. was this totally vaporous credit insurance market where the incentive is to manufacture debt and insure it,
yeah.
that they weren't going to resolve that, that instead they were literally going to go to a computer and hit the zero key a bunch of times. They're like, well, watch this, one, two, three, got another trillion, that's pretty good. Which is why I just like to get in there and just hit the delete key three times. I'm like, yeah, watch this, yeah, about
that's
that,
simple.
You know, the other way. You want to make it, I can get rid of it. You know, all we got to do is, if we need an index finger, we can do it. We got plenty of those, you know.
But, you know, the bankers, the insurance guys, the regulators, the screaming guys on TV, you're enough of a student of human nature, you know that they look in the mirror and they don't see a greedy bastard. They see an okay guy.
Yeah.
And most of these kind of public lunacies, these collapses, they always start with something logical. It just gets carried into a lunatic realm. That insurance had a good origin.
It still does.
Well, there you go. At what point does it go crazy, and at what point is someone a greedy bastard?
Yeah. Well, you're a greedy bastard when you're using other people's money.
They're always using other people's money.
Right. Well, it's one thing if you're using other people's money partially. It's another thing if you are using everybody else's money and none of your money. And so to give you a little bit more, to expound on that just a little bit, you have to understand, Wall Street used to make its money on the spread, right? You'd buy the stock at 50 and you'd sell the stock at 50 and a half and you'd make 50 cents every time it happened. It's good money. Or the bond market's the same thing, commodity market's the same thing. And technology hits and all of a sudden you have decimalization. And now where they used to make 50 cents, they're making a penny. And the Bloomberg terminal comes online and all of a sudden they're, instead of making, you know, whatever the spread was, they're making 1/128. It's less than a penny. And what happened as you move to the late 90s, the same thing that happened to music with Napster and all the rest of it was happening to Wall Street. But unlike music, the Eastern elite banking apparatus has an expectation of preserved status regardless of what happens in the world, and they were able to exploit their access to power to sell a narrative to the press and to the government that modern technology had invented this magic money machine that could distribute risk around the world using computers in a way that would liquefy all of the trapped capital, all the value of every building, all the value of every insurance policy. All of a sudden, all this money would be available to all of us, and we would be able to have the untold prosperity. What they didn't tell us was that the people running that system were actually not putting any capital up, and that their incentive was not, as a normal investor's incentive would be, to make sure that you and I are aligned,
okay,
that it is to exploit that.
Okay. At the heart of it was this financial problem. In your book, you also talk about a healthcare cabal, an energy problem.
Yeah.
Also, at the top, greedy bastards.
Yeah.
Is this a systemic problem?
Yeah.
The elites and the most trusted people of our country? What happened?
Remember, we had 40 years to make the transition from the agricultural environment of this country to the industrial environment of this country.
Okay.
We are asking ourselves and our most powerful and elite institutions to make the transition from the industrial universe to the digital universe basically in a weekend. And that is a remarkably terrifying thing for the incumbent systems. And what you are seeing, whether...
Why should that corrupt them?
Because at the end, when what you do is no longer of value...
Mm-hmm.
Because there are all these disruptions and bypasses, and you are a human being who has both not only an ego, but an interest in your own self-preservation. As you become more and more threatened, I believe you're more and more inclined to pursue more and more desperate measures.
You're describing a very interesting situation then, because in their heart of hearts, they don't believe the system is sustainable, so they're getting theirs and getting out, in a sense. They're building a kind of cushion.
Maybe.
Okay.
Some yes, some no. I think it's incentives, too.
They're gaming the system. Because
they are.
They don't really believe in this. They've grown cynical about the system.
Yes, but also we have it, like, let's look at electricity. You talked about energy. Let's look at electricity in California.
Yeah.
If you run a utility in California, so you're the CEO of PG&E or whatever it is. The way you're going to get a bigger bonus this year or any year is if you sell more electricity.
Mm-hmm.
You get paid by how much electricity you sell. whether we waste all of that electricity, and we talk about how our stationary power generation efficiency ratio in this country is 34%, which was established by Dwight Eisenhower, still have it. Japan's at 90%, Germany's at 80%. It's not even a rocket. It's just a cost of upgrading. It's not even a rocket science solution. They put a heat shield over it and recapture it and run the heat back through the factory. It's ridiculous. But what you're looking at, imagine if the CEO of PG&E was instead compensated not for how much electricity he or she is selling, but by the efficiency ratio of the electricity that is being sold.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there's a combination of using the pension funds like CalPERS and the shareholder base to force compensation restructuring at a lot of these greedy bastard industries to reward the executives for achieving what it is we need from them.
Yes.
And right now we're rewarding them for the simple act. Look at healthcare. You know, we have the world's best sickness treatment systems, bar none. But we have terrible health. But our compensation model pays for really effective sickness treatment,
right,
as opposed to health. Our energy model pays for prolific energy sales, whatever it might be, whatever the hydrocarbon or non-hydrocarbon is, but we don't pay the executives for the efficiency ratios. And it's only through the context of the outside pressure, but also our decision to pressure on the shareholder level using the pensions. I believe that the pensions of the teachers, of the police, of the people of this country are the single greatest leverage that we hold right now to affect a redirection in the compensation model at the industries that we most depend on to better align their interests with the interests
of you're asking for shareholder activism on the part of the pension funds.
We are in desperate need of exactly that. That, I believe...
the heads of pension funds.
It is very disappointing.
They went to Wharton with the guys who were at Goldman.
They also like to play golf with them and all the rest of it. I understand, but that doesn't mean that in the financial press
this is a conundrum. Like if we had broader voting in the country, we would have a system, too.
If we're a capitalist country, we have to influence our own capital base.
How do you change those things?
You change those things, as we have seen. One person I talked to a lot about this is Lynn Turner, who's a former chief accountant at the SEC, sits on the board of directors for the Colorado Pension Fund, and has actually managed to pass a couple of new bylaws in the Colorado pension system such that pensions can no longer purchase securities of publicly traded companies that don't disclose their political donations.
Okay.
So that's another way to play with this game. And what you have to do is literally go to the state capitals and advocate and hire lawyers and move to pressure at each state capital in this country to influence those things. There's no one silver bullet, but the combination of the external narrative that we're all participating in and the intelligence and strategery, to use a non-word, is the use of the inside game, which is the capital base of the pension funds, to pressure not only compensation reform but also disclosure from those organizations, and demand that they acknowledge the need to align our interests, their interests, the pension manager's interests. They're the custodian. Mm-hmm. They are the custodian of our capital, and they are custodially corrupt.
You know, many CEOs, many
I like a lot of them.
Funds. Yeah. Do you think they know when they are bad actors?
Yeah.
Okay.
Some do and some don't. I think it's hard to generalize that answer.
Okay.
I think some do and some don't.
Let me just tweak that a bit, too. You know, we speak of greedy bastards at an elite level, but our pension system is in crisis.
Yeah.
And while there aren't a lot of scientific samples, there are anecdotal samples about various civil servants working extra overtime in their last year, particularly in the police and fire, you know, working a lot of overtime in the last year to get a huge pension that would be out of line with what their actual earnings were. Are they greedy bastards?
They're exhibiting greedy bastard behavior, yeah.
That'd be a yes.
No, they're not, because you phrase the question as if you wanted me to identify them as greedy bastards. And I don't...
So you think there are no greedy bastards, there is just
there
greedy
is no
bastard
identity.
Behavior.
Yeah, there is no identity of greedy bastard. Every person is capable of that
behavior.
The fault
is not in the stars, it is in ourselves.
Yes, sir.
Okay,
yes.
We need to look in the mirror.
Judge us by our deeds.
So isn't this the stuff they used to teach in civics class?
It is ridiculous that I'm making a living
How
saying
did this
something
get started?
So simple and so
yeah.
stupid.
What the heck happened? You know? No, seriously. Like,
it's
you know,
an, I know, I agree
if,
with
if you.
If
you wanted to look for the long and deep core origins of this, you wanted to root this out deeply,
right.
what would you look to? Where do you think this got started? What caused this kind of fearful and ultimately corrosive behavior?
Again, it goes to that. It's the rate of change. We are at a period of remarkable change in this country, and change begets a tremendous amount of fear. I actually have a solution to that.
Go.
A very simple one. Fear causes, when you're afraid, your leg veins dilate and all the blood leaves your brain, and then you're making decisions with less blood in your brain, so your decisions are terrible.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we need to be doing is wearing tight stockings anytime we make a decision.
I see.
That's my the simplest solution that I can
keep your socks
yeah,
up
yeah,
is
yeah,
his
pull
solution.
Up your socks before
yeah,
you make
you
a decision.
Okay. Let's take a question from the audience here. Access and delivery of health care services appears to be a rigged system. No pushback from you there.
No.
Do you agree with this assertion? And if so, are there signs the U.S. will be able to gain control of runaway health care costs? Or are death panels the answer? Their words, not mine.
So obviously, yes, in terms of everything except for the death panels. And yes, there not only is there a way out that has already been being exhibited and practiced in this country, it's a stunningly effective one. We talk about it in the book with a gentleman named Dr. Brenner, who works out of Camden, New Jersey. And if you're interested in healthcare research, the most interesting places to do it are in the poorest communities in this country, because the poorest communities in this country are not monopolized by the profit-seeking apparatus, and so there's much more flexibility to do things. What Dr. Brenner did in Camden, New Jersey, which is a very poor city in this country, is he went to the hospitals and the insurance companies, and he said, can you identify for me what percentage of the healthcare users are consuming what percentage of the healthcare? And what he found was that 1% of the population in Camden, New Jersey, was accounting for 30% of the overall healthcare expenditures. And if you look at the data in this country, 5% of our population results in 50% of our healthcare expenditures today. So what Dr. Brenner did was he identified the actual buildings where those people lived, because you can do that with discrete data now, and went in and spoke with them and said, listen, you know, whoever the person was, I see that you're going to the emergency room three times a week, and are you enjoying that? And typically people say, well, no, I don't really like going to the emergency room three times a week. And then Dr. Brenner said, well, how would you like it if I hired somebody to come check on you every day, make sure you're taking your medicine, take you out for a walk, all these sorts of very ridiculously simple things. Again, hard to believe you can make a living doing it, but there it is. And in launching this program, he was able to reduce the healthcare costs by simply targeting the 1% that was creating that cost level and reducing the cost on that by 50% in that 1%. So it's 50 basis points out of the whole thing, half a percent, results in a 30%, sometimes 40% reduction in overall healthcare costs. And so instead of looking at, well, how much do we have to spend on healthcare, and what are we going to, we're going to have to just start killing people when they turn 90, no matter what, that's it, lights out, we're pushing you off the back of the boat, you know, get on. We actually have the intelligence and the data. In the industrial era, we were not capable of identifying through discrete data what percentage of the people are resulting in the expenditure of that healthcare and intervening with them. But the most interesting thing that Dr. Brenner ran into was, as he was yielding this effectiveness, which is saving all this money and all this is going, that the doctors are pushing back, because they're saying, well, what do you mean they don't need to keep come getting these tests? It's hurting my P&L. What, the insurance companies are pushing back. So if the problem is that good health is bad for the healthcare business. And so it goes to the incentives.
You don't give people drugs to keep well.
That's right. That's right. But the thing that I think that is most inspiring for me in the research of this book, and that was just one anecdote, is that you look around, there are people are doing amazing things. I call them super innovations, where you can basically drop the cost of doing something 99% while simultaneously exploding the impact by the same order of magnitude. Well, and we're in this sort of false debate between taxes and austerity and tax. And I think of the scene in the trash compactor in Star mm-hmm. Wars, and the two walls, one wall is taxes and the other one is austerity. And we're like, are we just going to starve the poor people or tax the rich people? And you're like, well, we're in for $700 trillion. And you're like, well, is there enough tax money to pay 700? No, well, no. Well, what if we don't feed anybody? Can't pay for that either. We need to leap out of the trash compactor and actually renovate the house. And people like Dr. Brenner, I think, are showing the way.
Well,
to
it's
do that.
Interesting in describing how you wanted to address the financial crisis and the insurance problem, the swaps, was to surface the problem
right.
by having it put on an exchange where everybody could
examine it. That's what I actually thought we were doing.
And what Dr. Brenner did, in a sense, was surfacing the problem by identifying these things. That kind of transparency is a means for a common approach.
It's a methodology.
Do you think things are inherently opaque, or the complexity of our times makes them opaque, or there are interests involved in keeping them opaque?
All of the above,
yeah.
But I think it's a legacy of the industrial era when it was not, you could not figure out which building and which apartment had the person who was spending the most money of everybody in the town of Camden. It didn't exist. There was no record keeping to do that. And I think that we are at a point now where, for the first time in the history of the world, we can achieve those things. And so a lot of what we're dealing with is really just a legacy of the way we have made decisions.
Well, that's interesting in another level.
And that's
level.
Some compassion, I think. You have to think, you know, we owe a gratitude. We are where we are because a lot of these systems. At the same time, we have to, obviously.
They brought hazards as well. Who
yes,
knew?
Yeah.
Yeah. But Adam Smith, when he talked about the invisible hand, the lesser seen part of that was he said, greed would be kept in check because people would value their public esteem. They wouldn't want to
nobility.
Be accused of being seen as greedy. But in a global system, you can disappear into opacity very quickly.
Yep.
Your deeds aren't seen in the same way as in a small-scale financial operation like
right.
London in the 18th century.
Yep. No,
so
that's
can
right.
you surface that kind of behavior again in the financial markets? Do you want that kind of thing to take place where everyone is tagged to every trade?
Yeah.
Where the AIG executives are seen publicly?
Why wouldn't you? I mean, that is the answer. And it's you know, yes.
Okay, I'll take another one from the audience then. That was good. If the 2008 crash was a result of collision by the greedy banksters and government, is there any belief you have that a correction in housing can take place without a further giveaway to the greedy banks?
Oh, absolutely.
What's going to happen?
Listen, the end game for this, I don't know when it'll happen, will be a significant global debt restructuring. When you understand the scale of the liabilities that we are up against, keep mentioning the $708 trillion, there is no bailout, there is no tax code, there is no austerity. That's why the austerity measures and the tax debate is so tragic. Because you are really forcing the most vulnerable with the austerity to pay the highest proportional price for something that is going to have zero impact on reconciling this issue. This is not a new thing, right? I mean, and we talk about it in that book. Mm-hmm. After World War II, they were aware that if we did not forgive or renegotiate or restructure Germany and Japan's debt and implement mercantilist trading practices with currency rigging on purpose to deliberately create a flow of capital into Germany and Japan, that it was not going to be a good way forward. Now, we didn't do that for World War I. And so it is clear by the scale of the problem that what is being called for, and this is not from my mouth, listen to the Committee for Economic Development, the largest NGO in the world.
Mm-hmm.
They wrote the last Marshall Plan. One of their most significant participants today is Andrew Liveris, who is the CEO of Dow Chemical. And they are out calling for another Marshall Plan because they understand what we're talking about. And they know that you're not going to have the necessary investment in this country until you restructure that debt. The most interesting thing is how do you do it, right? And that's where it was sort of fun to get a chance to interview Dick Grasso about putting swaps on exchanges, because he's the one that gave me the idea of declaring all naked swaps or credit insurance that's sold on something that doesn't actually exist. So the swaps market is so bad that not only are they selling insurance on things that do exist without collateral, but they're also selling insurance on things that don't exist. For instance, there are credit default swaps that trade on General Motors, but General Motors doesn't have any debt. So why are we selling debt insurance on General Motors debt when they don't have the debt? And Grasso's suggestion was to reclassify those types of swaps as online gaming, which is what they are. It's just a bet on whether you can pay your bills.
I was going to say, they say you can't get rich writing fiction.
No, that's it. I mean, truly, you know, I mean, Arianna Huffington has a great line that she's using on her speaking circuit right now, which is, in America, we used to make things, and now we just make things up. And there is no better evidence of that than the swaps market. But at the same time, when you're like, oh, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? And then I literally ran into Dick Grasso on the sidewalk, who I used to harass miserably when he was taking all that money out, and he'd be like, oh, Dick, I'm sorry to say that. Should take the $200 million, you know what I'm saying?
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, I'm like, oh, you took $200 million, you know, it's just non-profit, you know?
We're getting a little inside here.
No, but at the same time, he truly did, I mean, he understands how an exchange functions. And I said, well, what do you do with the swaps market? And he said, well, you just declare them, anything that's not insuring anything as what it is, online gaming, declare it null and void. And in so doing, you will force a bank restructuring. And I said, well, would you email me an actual rule change that I could use to go to the SEC with, which he did. Mm-hmm. One of the two things that I'm most excited about this year is to use the Grasso rule change with my friends at the SEC. So far, they're not super responsive.
Hope springs eternal.
Yeah, well, you know.
Let's try your other big thing, the 30 million jobs tour. You said that launched today. What's that about?
That is first and foremost an effort on my part. It goes to what we were talking about before. If you don't understand the problem, you can't solve the problem. And we obviously have a huge jobs debate in this country. But we have one political party and the Democrats that's pushing for a couple million jobs, which is wonderful. And then you have another political party that's pushing for a million, million, five jobs, whatever. Well, what we need is 30 million jobs. And it is insulting to us as a country to be financing a massive political apparatus that proclaims to be, and a media apparatus along with it that proclaims to be indulging in a jobs debate when in fact, they are not. Even if we did everything all of them want, we would have 2 million jobs. Now we need 28 million more. And the amount of work that you have to do for that is tremendous. And so, I wanted to set the size of the problem. And two, I wanted to establish that there is no linear solution to create 30 million jobs. It's ridiculous. Nobody knows how to create 30 million jobs. But what we do know is that if you don't have investment, if you do not have a culture of investment in your country, which we do not have because of our bank policies, because of our tax code, and because of our trade policies, creating any level of prosperity is impossible. But if you do have investment and you can create gardens or ecosystems, that from those ecosystems, 30 million jobs can grow. And if you put together these ecosystems, we are in the Valley, which is sort of the cliched but best example of a cradle of innovation, not only in the country, but in the world with Stanford and the money and all the things that happen and all the jobs that are created there. And my whole thing is every problem is a job, right? So we've got a lot of problems, which we've got a lot of people without work. And we have money, so clearly we just need to figure out a better way to mix them together. And the understanding of the scale of the problem and the understanding that you want to be creating environments with education, entrepreneurialism, and investment, and a commitment to what I call the pillars of industry, infrastructure, energy, and health in this country, that through doing that and driving investment and forcing the reform that we need in banking, taxes, and trade to do that is the only way to create 30 million jobs, and that is the debate that we need to be having in this country, not this nonsense of where people just say jobs and then they have one little line item that might create 100,000 jobs here for this week or this month, when not only have we failed to define a job as something that solves a problem, we've just defined a job as something where I give you some money for a while. That's not a job.
You know, the Valley is good at creating jobs, but they're typically a small number of very elite jobs involving software.
Yep.
Looking at your website, the fixes you have for education and healthcare involve sweeping changes in government policy. Do you think it's possible to do that in this current environment without being just shut down as a socialist? Do you think it's possible to create 30 million jobs in these enormous sectors, which can employ many people, without just being tarred as a socialist?
Absolutely.
And disregarded?
Absolutely. Because if you drive the narrative not through, oh, the government has to do this, or the government has to tell private industry to do this, but through the narrative of America's own aspirations to its own, the nobility of its identity and really what it represents in the world, by saying we are going to reform our tax, trade, and bank policy to precipitate a cascade of investment in this country that will result in those jobs, that the suggestion that restructuring bank, trade, and tax policy to make tax policy less of a pile of Swiss cheese and one that encourages investment, to make trade policy not a rigged policy but a fair trade policy. Remember, China reset its currency to 50% of the U.S. dollar at a meeting in a room in 1994.
That's interesting.
It actually happened. They did it. It was a meeting. They set their tax policy where they tax our imports into China at 25% and we tax their imports to America at 2.5%. These are facts.
Yes.
And again, there's nothing. The thing that it's interesting is that I sort of carry on about this constitutional amendment for money and politics. And so if you look at the amendment to move the voting age to 18, it was a justice narrative. It's unjust for a young man or woman to be fighting in a war that on behalf of a president they cannot vote for. Subsequently, the ERA emerged, which similarly on a justice narrative, but presented and pursued through a political lens as a leftist agenda. Failed. And I believe that the key to solving the problem that you just suggested, which is, well, Radigan's a socialist, or this is a socialist agenda.
Yeah, it's a big government solution.
But this is not a big government solution, in fact. This is a justice solution that suggests that the gates of the rulemaking need to be made fair. I believe that whether it's the Tea Party or the occupation or people who are completely disenfranchised,
I wanted to get to that.
Yeah, that those people really are clamoring for justice more than anything else in the rulemaking, that the issue is not equality, that the issue is equity and inequity. And there is a sense in this country, and it's an accurate sense, that the relative opportunity for a given individual is different based on their relative status. And that, I believe, is the most offensive and least American thing. So, I mean, listen, and you're the communist that wants to give special favors to... Yeah, you are. I found him.
I'm coping.
I found it at, no.
I'm coping. But so to fill the circle out, perhaps you said some of the greedy bastard behavior is driven by this acceleration into a new kind of economy, a new kind of world. The solution is to admit that and embrace it.
Right.
And not just treat the status quo ante like it can go on forever.
But at the same time, it's also to have it's easy to sit outside the castle and argue how the castle should behave.
Yeah.
My job is easy that way. Your job is easy that way. At the same time, we must remember, well, there's 311 million of us, 545 of them, right? So we got pretty good odds, right? If we can agree to anything, if we can get into the business of agreeing to one or two things and out of the business of disagreeing about everything, we can disagree for days, that you are in a situation for the first time that allows you to confront the entire apparatus to change itself to reflect that. And I think that is really the treasured opportunity that we have right now as a generation.
Take this question from the audience and with an append. Yeah. Do you think that the reason there is an increase in greedy bastard behavior in many people is due to the fact that the 1% keeps telling the 99% that they can be just like them? And what do you think about the Occupy movement?
I love the Occupy movement. I think the Occupy movement, I say that not as a referendum on a given protest, but as a referendum on the principles that are represented in the wave of that energy. Here's what I actually think. I believe that a couple things. One, I think we have come to the point where we have a misguided perception that money equals happiness.
And as the questioner said, that everyone can win the lottery.
Right. Or that the fact that the ambition to winning the lottery is in some way going to make you more satisfied. When the body of research that continues to circulate and on is after whatever the number is, $60,000, $70,000, there's absolutely zero incremental increase in your proportional happiness, whatever that might be. And so happiness is much better defined and actually reveals itself through the quality of your relationships with other people and your ability to manifest your own potential. And people who are manifesting their potential and have healthy relationships with those around them are much more satisfied. And it is the illusion that achieving the possession of more money will result in happiness is, I think, a huge part of that issue.
I have to take a pause and say you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest today is Dylan Radigan, MSNBC host and author of Greedy Bastards: How We Can Stop Corporate Communist Banksters and Other Vampires from Sucking America Dry.
Isn't it fun to say?
Yeah.
It's fantastic.
It's fun to say. It's therapeutic.
It's a little angry making.
Well, you know, listen.
You're an angry man.
No, no, we're lizard brain. Remember, we're meeting them where they are.
Yeah, well, you're on lizard brain TV.
No, I understand. Listen, the lizard brain is where it's at. You know, that's the only way to get things done.
Sells a lot of products and stops people from changing the channel, and that's the problem with cable TV.
The opportunity.
What's the opportunity?
My opportunity is to meet them where they are and take them where we're going. Hmm. Right? But if we don't meet them where they are, we can't take them where we're going.
Okay. You know, it occurred to me the other day, the founding fathers were the 1%, weren't they?
Hell yeah. Hell yeah.
And we've had many elites in this country who were benevolent, benign, however you want to put it. We've had others who were exploitative. Is there a signal, a season, a reason why some are good and some are less good? Or do you think the founding fathers are put on too much of a pedestal and they were the
ones?
Well,
no, I think, here's what I think. What America is valuable, not to just to ourselves, but to the world, because of the documented aspirations in its founding, not because of the identity of the founders. And so,
not an original intent guy. Eh?
Everybody knows that originally this was a country that was meant to be just for white men who own land and that everybody else needed to shut up. The reality is the document that they published for white men who own land was an aspiration to a justice narrative that I believe this country since its founding has been continually aspiring to achieve. And I think that we're just the latest latest wave of humanity in this country to come up against the remarkable shortfall that exists in this country relative to our ambition, the aspiration that was set as the identity for this nation. But I also think it's critical to understand that we have an opportunity, and really I would think of it as an obligation, not just to ourselves, but to the rest of the world. The America's greatest export could be a just and decent and transparent government. And the greatest weapon that America holds relative to the earth right now is our capacity to model that. And yeah, we have never achieved it. We're a slave owning state. We believe women were property for a very long time. We still, by the way, are a remarkably racist country, at least insofar as the way we treat young black and Hispanic men in this country. We systematically incarcerate them. Remember, we have more black men in prison in this country today than we had slaves in 1850. No joke. And that just means we have a lot of work to do. But the difference between this country and our government and China or Western Europe or South America or wherever it is that we are the only country in the world that has a documented aspiration.
Our operator's manual has a means to
fix
that.
Yeah. And I think that that is really the distinguishing characteristic. And that's sort of the fun part of being us, and that is what no one else gets to do that, and it's being corrupted by gerrymandering, it's being corrupted by closed primaries, and obviously it's been heavily corrupted by money in politics, but we have means to deal with that as well. At least I get to come here and talk to you guys. Nobody's killed me yet, right? In other countries, you wouldn't be allowed to have journalism in any way, shape, or form in this country
that
addresses.
I think you're in a reasonably safe room.
Yeah, you never know.
There you go. Another politics question.
San Francisco is, these guys.
I know.
Those hippies.
It's getting late, too.
Getcha.
As Silicon Valley views failure as just scar tissue, what do you see as Obama's scar tissue, and what has he learned from it? Why don't you handicap the president? How's he done in your view?
So the president, for me, is guilty of original sin. And the president, not in the religious sense, but in the policy sense. And the original sin was his refusal to resolve the financial crisis in the way that it had to be resolved. And unfortunately, for him...
Say more about that, because that's a broad statement.
Well, specifically... As I've discussed, there is a need to restructure the debt markets, specifically the credit insurance markets, in order to actually facilitate investment in this country.
When he threw a ton of money at the banks, should have extracted a quid pro quo.
Yes.
Yeah.
And a restructuring. And when he failed to do that, he failed to not only use the power that he was given at the time of his election, but he also failed to redirect the investment flows that are leaving this country back into it.
Is there a way to fix that now?
I don't know. Yes, there is a way to fix it, but it will come from the outside in. Can I just say a little bit more about the president beyond that, though?
Go.
Just because in fairness to him, beyond that particular issue, which is one that I still, and if you've seen me on the television show, I'm merciless on this administration relative to their failure to do that. But I do believe that this president has much greater aspirations to attempt to bring some of the equality and the more balanced environment that we would aspire to. But it's almost as if, like, he's trying to deal with step 6, 7, and 8, but he hasn't dealt with step 1, 2, and 3. And the problem is step 1, 2, and 3 are really hard. And steps 6, 7, and 8 are much more politically popular across the board. And that, to me, is not only the failure of this president, but it's been the failure of a number of recent presidents. And I think that the difference in President Obama's case is that he came in with a tremendous expectation that he would address our first step issues and our second step issues, and hasn't done that.
Another question from the audience. What role will campaign finance reform play in the future? And to append, what do you think are... What do you think of these enormous war chests being built up on both sides in the coming election?
I love them. I absolutely adore them.
You... Media guy, political advertising. Let me see.
Pays my rent. Oh, yeah. Buy me a new boat after this presidential election.
That would make
me?
You a That would make you a greedy bastard.
The reason I say that is because I believe the preposterous display of distorted and manipulated behavior we're going to see through money will be the single greatest recruiting vehicle in the history of the world for us to form municipal coalitions in 2012.
This time we've gone too far?
This is it, baby.
Many have fallen at that stage.
No. But look at the actions. Los Angeles has already passed a resolution. Money is not speech. Corporations are not people. New York has passed a resolution. Money is not speech. People are not... corporations are not people, whatever it is. We all know what it is. Portland, same thing. Boulder, same thing. I'm waiting on San Francisco. I don't know what's going on around here. You guys claim to be righteous, but I can't even see any action. I don't know. You guys like to talk about it. But we'll see when San Francisco gets it together. But I do believe ultimately, while those are symbolic gestures, right, the municipal resolution is useless, okay? People say, that's not going to do anything. You're right, it's not going to do anything. But what it is going to do is it's going to allow like-minded people within their communities to find one another, such that as we build these municipal coalitions and use 2012 as a recruiting vehicle for that, that will be in a posture to build states in 2012. Montana has actually thrown down the gauntlet. Montana Supreme Court has ruled explicitly that corporations cannot fund elections in that state. That is an actual lawsuit that has actually been completed that will actually go, potentially, I think it will, go to the Supreme Court to challenge Citizens United. If we continue to develop the municipal momentum that is symbolic to find one another, that it is the bricks of those municipalities in every state in America that will have the opportunity to build states in 2013. As we build municipalities in 2012, we build states in 2013, that I actually believe if we really do the work this year on the municipal level so that we can build the states next year, that we can ultimately deliver a coup de grace to money and politics in 2014. I think that a national strategy can emerge if there is an aggressive organization on a municipal level this year that allows us to build those states.
Some kind of mass mobilization of local information sharing.
Yeah, it's happening. It is what's happening. It's just a matter of the rate at which it happens. So whether 2014 is right or whether it's 2016 or 2020, the fact of the matter is we are already seeing the municipal engagement develop in this country, which is the only place that we can really affect power right now. And the more aggressively and the more rapidly we are able to do that, then the more rapidly we'll be able to build states. And as we build states, then obviously we'll be able to build a nation in 2012. Remember, 90%, you look at the Yuan Talk polling, 88-90% of the American people all agree on this very simple issue. This is not this, and 90-10 issues are not don't happen for the simple reason that we don't organize to do it. And what is happening in this country right now is the beginning of the process of organizing to rectify an obvious and sort of idiotic construct. My favorite thing with corporations and people is Ben and Jerry and Ben and Jerry's. You meet Ben Cohen. He's like a rich Jewish guy. And you meet Jerry Greenfield, he's like a crazy partying guy. You're like, oh, these are guys. That's a nice guy. How you doing? And then you have a pint of Ben and Jerry's, and you're like, man, it's good ice cream.
Yeah.
It's good. And then you're like, there's clearly nothing in between the corporation that is Ben and Jerry's that is has anything in common with the identity of the men that are Ben Cohen and Jerry Greenfield. And you know, I mean, listen, this is one of those ones. I think you have to laugh about this because it's ridiculous. So, you know. My favorite thing on Twitter is I just say, you know, give me your favorite reasons why corporations are not people. You know, and they're like, well, they never cheat on their spouse.
Right.
You know, they can't pee.
I guess
in the...
you've never heard of a tender offer.
Yeah.
It's a financial
joke. That's good. That's
joke.
Financial
there,
humor.
There you go.
Only at the Commonwealth Club.
There you go. Shows at 7 and 9.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the wealth gap a minute. Romney speaks of Obama's entitlement society and alleging that transfers of wealth are creating a European-style welfare state. For three decades, all GNP growth, though, the questioner says, have gone from the middle and lower classes in the U.S. to the top 1%. What policies of investment will reverse the inequality trend without leading to more tax and spend, big government liberalism?
Municipal. It is only through I'm not qualified to answer that question. First of all, let me say that.
Okay.
It is through the community. The communities need to decide what the investment policies are that best serve them. But the one thing that I would say to that statement, remember, if you are a presidential candidate, the only thing you have to do is make the other guy look worse than you. That's your only objective. And so what they do as a business apparatus is they say, what are the lizard brain words, like my Greedy Bastards cover, that I can put in the presidential candidate's mouth that will make people feel that the other guy is worse? And so I think it's almost one of those things where...
It's that oppositionist speech again.
Yeah. And really, I think it's on us to... We have to become more and more aware of when people are serious and acknowledge that these people aren't serious, that these aren't serious. We're not being subjected to serious conversations at a time when we're in desperate need of serious conversations.
Oh, my gosh, you want to look the enemy in the eye and see them as a human being.
Well, anyway, we have no choice. They are human beings.
Yeah, well,
they're not corporations.
It's not the most popular stance on a lot of
people. Did you like the Colbert thing, with Mitt Romney as a serial killer? That was unbelievable. Did you see that?
I did not.
Where all the corporations that he killed... It's too good.
Want to get to a...
He's a serial killer.
We have time for two more questions, but I'm trying to... This travels to the soul of Dylan Radigan.
All right.
As a liberal in the financial industry, are you lonely?
So, first of all, there are many problems with that question. One, I'm not a liberal. Two, I'm not in the financial industry. And three, my loneliness has nothing to do with it.
We didn't come to hear about your existential dread.
If you want to get into that, it's a different night, and you don't want to be there.
Yeah. This man's a smoker. Can stockholders induce companies or mutual fund organizations to rein in the excessive compensation packages of CEOs?
Yeah, that is the only mechanism. And not only can stockholders alter the compensation structure...
Can you fire your pension fund manager if he doesn't?
That is the question, and the answer is yes, but you have to literally accumulate influence on the board of directors of your state pension. And beyond that, it is imperative that we pressure our state pensions to only purchase publicly traded securities of companies who disclose their political donations. They should refuse to invest in publicly traded companies who secretly drive money to political efforts. Bill de Blasio back in New York has done a tremendous job with the New York pensions on doing exactly that and publicly shaming the companies that do it as basically being incapable of competing in a fair environment. That there's no better evidence of the fact that you don't have what it takes to be in the business you're in than your need to pay off the government to change the rules to keep you in that business.
We have a number of other questions here that I'm going to try to encapsulate as a large one. What do you think about the state of big media?
Big media is... What do I think about the state of big media? It's what's the right adjective?
It's a family show.
Big media is in a state of desperate self-preservation, and that is costing America its ability to use its most powerful resource to confront its government. Big media is participating in the exact same thing that every other aspect of our economy is, which is the monetization of attention-seeking over the our economy right now does not particularly value intellectual property or production. Our economy values attention-seeking, and as a result, it has created a hugely misaligned incentive for big media to behave in an atrocious manner relative to the reason it exists. The same way banks exist, we give banks special privileges and we give them special access to money. The same way we allow police to carry weapons because we expect the police to provide for our security. We expect the banks to provide adequate financing for our government. And we expect the media to confront our politicians on behalf of the interest of this country. And those things are not happening, but lest we be sort of demoralized by that. Obviously, the bypass mechanisms are more than in place, and I'm hoping that we'll see more and more of it.
Are you grateful to be in big media?
I am. I am remarkably grateful to be in big media, because if I did not have the partnership and sort of the risk appetite, quite honestly, that Phil Griffin at MSNBC has had to allow me to continue to do this, or John Karp, who's the CEO at Simon & Schuster, I wouldn't be in this room, this book wouldn't exist, and this message wouldn't exist. And that goes to the compassion narrative. It's easy to demonize anybody, but at the same time, we have to acknowledge that there are people inside of those organizations who have the same aspirations that we do, and have the same goals that we do, and some of those people have been instrumental in allowing me the opportunity to do what I'm doing, and it's... I'm grateful for that.
Well, I'm so happy we were able to end on a note of gratitude, because it's such an underutilized sentiment.
Yeah.
Costs nothing and gives back enormously.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, that is all we have time for. Our thanks to Dylan Radigan, host of The Dylan Radigan Show on MSNBC and the author of Greedy Bastards. We also thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the Internet. We also want to remind everyone here that copies of Dylan Radigan's book are on sale in the lobby, where he will be pleased to sign them immediately following the program. We therefore appreciate your allowing him to make his way to the lobby as quickly as possible. I'm Quentin Hardy, and now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.
Thank you.
That was a lot of fun.
Yeah, thank you very much.
I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.